You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, new figures show that net migration to the UK remains at near record levels. All sides of the EU referendum debate claim that this proves that they were right all along. My guests Xenia Wickett and Martin Plout will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including still further rancour elsewhere in the EU over immigration, as Hungary's Prime Minister preemptively dismisses a deal on quotas and Greece ceases speaking to Austria. South Africa's economy grinds more or less to a total halt, despite the president's bold attempts to stimulate it by means of extending his house. And a Kennedy has some ideas about foreign affairs, although mercifully not the statutory power necessary to act on them. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24, live from London right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Xenia Wickett, head of the US and the Americas program at Chatham House, and Martin Plout, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Welcome both back to the show. Now, first up, if you are living here in the UK, you will probably have reflected several times already that there are still 4 months to go before the referendum on EU membership and wondered what it might cost to rent a quiet yurt outside Ulaanbaatar for the duration. Today's primary cause of scaremongering and blame deflecting on both sides is the release of figures showing that net migration to the UK remains at near record highs, despite years of promises to reverse it. Xenia, first of all, net arrivals of 323,000 in the year to September. The UK is still clearly an attractive country to many people. Isn't that a good thing?
Economically, broadly, yes, it is. There's little question. I spend most of my time working on the US, and the statistics are incredibly clear for the US and broadly similar for the UK, which is that immigration is a good thing for the American economy writ large. Immigration is a good thing for the British economy writ large. However, there are inevitably winners and losers in that. And if you happen to be a loser, which is to say that some immigrant takes a job that you could otherwise take, then it's less good for you on an individual basis. And so that's why, in part, you are seeing the kind of responses that we've seen to this migration debacle, if you will, because it really is one at the moment, at least the way it's being treated across Europe. Broadly writ, immigration tends to uplift the economy rather than bring it down.
Martin, is it, however, a good thing if you are a prime minister desperately hoping that you can win a referendum on EU membership for interminable months from now?
No. In a word, it is not. But, you know, the problem with all this is that one has to disaggregate these statistics. If there are 300,000 people, coming along, you have to look at who these people are. And there are some totally bonkers inclusions in that statistic. For example, if you're a Brit who has lived for, shall we say, 18 months in Milan and you come back, you are a migrant. I mean, did you know? It's completely insane. The other thing is that all the students who come to the universities here to learn at our universities, which we are desperately trying to encourage, are seen as migrants. They're in the same statistics. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that all of the statistics is untrue, and that's not difficult for a prime minister to deal with. But, I mean, the other two groups, really, that one can look at, who are absolutely essential to the British economy. One are, shall we say, the mathematicians and statisticians and techie people from South Korea and India, whom we just can't produce enough of. So what on earth would we do?
Journalists and current affairs broadcasters from Australia?
Yes, well, we can do without those, certainly. or from South Africa, my home place originally. Finally, of course, there are the jobs for which Brits are, let's put it bluntly, too damned lazy to do. So whether it's cleaning the loos or digging potatoes in Lincolnshire, there is no Brit that I've ever met that's dead keen on doing either of those jobs. So they'd better go and find somebody from somewhere else to do it. And that's why you get these people, because also we offer some decent salaries. These people are not coming for the benefits. And the problem is the whole story has been taken around benefits, as if they're coming for benefits. absolute nonsense. They come for jobs.
And the
weather, obviously.
Oh, the weather's wonderful, yes.
But, I mean, there's statistics, not in the ones that have just come out yesterday but or this morning, but there were statistics 6 or so months ago. You know, if you look at the taxes that these individuals pay, it is greater, funnily enough, than actually they take out in terms of social spending. I mean, again, you know, you've actually got to, as Martin says, you've got to look into the statistics of this. This has become a hugely political issue, not just in the UK, but across Europe and in the United States now in election season. But the statistics are far more complicated than just this, you know, big number of 323,000 net migration into the UK.
That's all true. But, of course, politically speaking, it isn't what matters, is it?
Politically speaking, it isn't what matters, because what tends to rise to the top in politics is a clear statement that is easy to sell. And the answer is that Farage has a much easier sell than does David Cameron. And this is really going to cause problems for him, and is causing problems for him, and is one of the factors that has motivated him to try and push forward the referendum as early as he can, because the reality is that the migrant crisis is only going to get worse during the year.
David Cameron, Martin Plout, is insisting again that the net migration figure will be under 100,000 people by 2020. He knows that's not true. Why does he keep saying it?
Because he won't be the Prime Minister. He won't have to deal with it by that time. But no, look, I mean, let's be fair. There is a reason why migrants are deeply unpopular with most of the British public, partly because they don't understand it. They just think, goodness me, we're having all these people and our culture is being diluted. We don't know what's going on, especially in areas where people actually don't meet many migrants.
This has always been the irony of it, that UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, when they're flourished, it tends to be in largely all white enclaves.
Exactly. But the other point, which, and people genuinely do have a case here, is there are two groups of people who are really deeply difficult to deal with. The one group are, shall we say, your Romanian plasterer, who is living perhaps four or five of them in one room, and your British plasterer, who charges, say, £15-20 an hour, discovers that his rates are being undercut by these four or five guys who are sleeping on the floor and, you know, being prepared to work for £7 or £8 pounds an hour, and he finds his wages going down. That is not much fun to be in. The other group are the Roma, who are deeply unpopular with every section of the population. I've actually been up in Oldham and met people who would spit blood about them. Why? Because they arrive, they have been shown to set up brothels in streets. They get involved in scrap metal operations and chuck all the rubbish into the areas which are supposed to be kept clean. They spit at people in the streets. They are really, really unpopular. Now, I'm sure there's a good sociological reason why they're behaving this way, but if you lived next to a Roma, you'd not be a happy bunny.
This is, of course, a infinitesimal minority of the
very, very small
of immigrants from the EU and indeed elsewhere. Does news like this, before we move on to a related story, Xenia, does it sway the possible result of the referendum at all, do you think? Or do you get the sense that the people who are going to vote on immigration have already made their minds up?
Absolutely it sways. As I was saying earlier, part of the logic for David Cameron bringing the referendum forward as much as he could is the reality is that as long as the troubles in the Middle East continue to go on, and I'm sure we will get to that later, there will continue to be migrants. And those migrants are going to make David Cameron's argument for why we should stay in the EU much harder to make, not because the economic reasons and the policy reasons and the security reasons become any less robust and valuable, but because what people see and what is tangible is the fact that people are taking, as I say, on an individual basis, and as Martin just laid out, people are taking their jobs. And that's what they see. That is tangible. That is about you as an individual. And that makes it that much harder for David Cameron to make the arguments that he is as to why the UK staying in is good. There is a point, though, that I think Theresa May made, which I think is a valid one. And again, it's not going to resonate in the political debate, which is, if we're out of the EU, does it make it any easier to actually stop the migrants? And the answer is, we have that much less control if we're out of the EU, in a sense. So actually, it's not altogether clear. We just don't know is the answer. It's not altogether clear. You can't make the argument that if we get out of the EU, we'll be able to stop the migrants better than if you're in the EU.
Well, that does lead us nicely into our next story, which is that while most modern European leaders are notably squeamish about addressing immigration bluntly, Hungary's somewhat unlovable Prime Minister Viktor Orban is afflicted by no such reticence. He's today been reported as snorting dismissively at reports of a deal between the EU and Turkey to distribute hundreds of thousands of refugees presently in Turkey throughout Europe. Orban has said that if he himself were to sign up for it, he would find himself dangling from a flagpole. Martin, you were speaking earlier about, a lack of public sympathy throughout Europe towards migrants and refugees, which was suspended briefly last summer following the publication of that dreadful photo of that poor kid being washed up on a beach. Is Orban the only EU leader, do you think, who actually understands this about European publics, or is Hungary a special case?
No, I think we're rapidly reaching a real crisis point. And I think that, NATO has already been sent to the Aegean to patrol up and down. Quite what it's going to do when it's patrolling up and down, I don't know, because they don't have orders to shoot the boats and sink the boats which are bringing people from Turkey to Greece.
There would be a certain degree of presentational difficulties with that.
There would be. The bodies would be, floating in the ocean. But, if Greece finds itself in a position where you have a million people arriving this year in Greece, or 800,000?
It's 100,000 already this year.
Exactly, and 800,000 plus arrived last year.
They're actually on course for a million plus this year.
Exactly. So if they arrive and they cannot move on from there, then I think that the Greeks will begin to take really drastic measures. I don't know what those measures are. I can't predict them, but I think that there will be blood in the water in the end.
On the subject of Greece, Xenia, they have today recalled their ambassador to Vienna after Austria held a conference with Balkan nations without inviting Greece. Austria, of course, has announced fairly drastic caps on the numbers it's prepared to admit or allow to cross its territory. How bad could this intra-European rancor get?
I'm with Martin, and we just don't know the answer to that question. But it could get really significantly worse. The European Union has all sorts of challenges right at the moment, but there's absolutely no question whatsoever that the migrant issue is top of those challenges, along with the economic stability of a number of countries, not least of which is Greece. I mean, there's really a couple of parts to this. What we're not talking about is... we're not talking about it so much because we actually truly don't know the answer to this. The only real solution to this is to actually stop the migrants needing to migrate, if you will, which means we've actually got to do something about the Middle East. And we don't know how to do anything about the Middle East or what we can do in the Middle East. So we're not talking about it. But the reality is that migrants are going to continue to come, whether it's from Iraq or from Syria or from Libya or elsewhere in the region, while they have the kind of security challenges that they have in their country. The other thing to note, and I think it's an important thing to note as we are debating about how many migrants we would take, or Europe is debating about how many migrants each country would take, you have to remember that Lebanon right now and Jordan, something like a third to a half of its population right now are refugees.
Lebanon has a comparable percentage as well, and that's on top of the sort of generations of Palestinian refugees already
exactly.
living in both
places. And we're
places.
Talking about perhaps a million in Greece. I don't know what the population of Greece is, but I can tell you it's going to be a lot.
A little bit bigger than London, Greece.
It's a lot less than the ratio that we're seeing in Jordan and Lebanon. And so I do think that there is an element that says until we can solve the problem of the Middle East, which clearly is not going to happen anytime soon, we do have to come up with a solution to these people, and we do have to recognize that there are some countries that right now are suffering significantly worse than the European states that we're talking about here.
Martin, how focusing an effect does it have for leaders of EU countries that if they cannot find some sort of solution, they might all find themselves on the opposition benches in parliaments now taken over by anti-immigration populists?
Oh, I think there's every chance of that, and especially if it is coupled with, and you mentioned briefly the question of an EU referendum. But I mean, if you've got a combination of factors where you've got another million arriving, plus Britain withdrawing from the EU, a euro crisis. I mean, we could be in really, really difficult waters, and we then are back in the territory that we last saw in the 1920s and 30s, which I do not want to be in.
But there's worth remembering, Martin's absolutely right. If the migrants continue to come, the governments that we are currently have in power will lose power, and they will be replaced by populist governments, who are still going to have to deal with the fact that there are millions of migrants flooding out of the Middle East and parts of Asia and coming to Europe. They're not going to stop just because the government changes. And the governments are not going to be able to build walls that will be effective to stop these people. So you'll get a change in government and they will have exactly the same challenge.
Martin, just finally on this subject, thinking about this next summit, which is due to occur on March the 7th in Brussels, do you think there is actually, have we yet reached the point at which people will do a deal because they've realised that whether they like it or they like the possible consequences or not, there just isn't an option at this point?
To be honest, I have no idea. I think that the people are just flailing around, and frankly, if I was in government, I'd be flailing with them. I have no idea, and I don't think anybody else does.
Okay, well, on that optimistic note, we are going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Xenia Wickett and Martin Plaut. Coming up next, South Africa, learning the hard way what happens when you let your national economy be managed for decades by bunglers and crooks.
Just grow like a tree with the roots very deep on earth.
For the best in food and hospitality, tune into The Menu.
I learned that from a potato farmer way up in northern Maine. And he baked me a potato and it was like eating the best thing ever.
Monaco's program on food and drink introduces you to the most inspirational chefs, dedicated producers and innovative restaurateurs.
Some cinnamon syrup, a half an ounce of that. Got our Bosca Schnapps, an ounce of this.
So when you need inspiration for your dinner plans or want to find a new place for a superb cocktail, tune into The Menu with me, Marcus Hippie, premiering every Friday at 1900 London time.
It was really the River Cafe where I really just had a deep relationship with carrots. Vegetables, sorry, I said to say carrots, but I love carrots, so I meant vegetables in general.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Xenia Wickett and Martin Plaut. And we turn now to South Africa, where those portions of the national economy not directly related to renovating the president's house are struggling so badly that even the people professionally interested in pretending everything's fine are admitting that it isn't. Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan has pronounced South Africa's economy in crisis, cutting this year's growth forecast from an already modest 1.7% to a positively humble 0.9%. The rand, already down 50% in the last 5 years, has reacted by falling further. Martin, there have been factors contributing to this beyond anybody's control, falling commodity prices around the world, a terrible, terrible drought. But how much of this has been made worse by bad governance?
Oh, very, very much so, unfortunately. We've gone downhill steadily from Nelson Mandela, who did a decent job. I'm just talking economically. He did a decent job economically. He left things more or less as they were, which left most wealth in white hands. But on the other hand, kept the show on the road and allowed the government to generate enough taxes to redistribute, which they've done fairly well, even if a lot of the spending has been corrupt. You then got Mbeki, who was worse. And we now have Jacob Zuma, who is an economic illiterate and is utterly incapable of running a hen coop when it comes to that. I mean, he is, somebody who was trained by the KGB and the Stasi and understands exactly how to run and manipulate things when it comes to party politics, but he hasn't the faintest idea about an economy. And the problem is that they've put burden upon burden upon burden on the South African economy, which the apartheid government had left in a fragile state already. And there was plenty of corruption before the ANC came to power. And it's important to remember that. But, you know, when you've added all these bricks on the load, I mean, the South African economy is just flagging and floundering. And there is no, I'd see no way out of it.
Senior Martin cites there a fairly depressing sequence of diminishing returns from Mandela to Mbeki to Zuma. How big a problem in terms of South Africa's economy is it that, as things have been and still really are, there isn't a plausible alternative government? It's the ANC still basically only has to turn up to win.
Give it time. I mean, you have seen the opposition government from a very, very low base at each national election actually do slightly better than the time before. You are seeing the opposition start to get greater support from the black community as well as the white. I mean, it's principally white party, but it's not exclusively anymore in the way it once was. Some of its leadership has changed. So you are beginning to see greater diversity. And you know, if what Martin says is true, which I have no reason to believe otherwise, and the economy is going to continue to tank and get worse, then people will, you know, in a democratic system, people will start looking for alternatives.
Martin, South Africa does nevertheless remain Africa's second biggest economy, I think I'm right in saying, behind Nigeria. Does this have an effect beyond its borders? Does it have a kind of black hole effect that drags in other neighbouring economies, or is it fairly isolated?
It is remarkably isolated, actually. I mean, it does have a big impact on the region. When we talk about the region, I mean just Southern Africa. But beyond that, it doesn't have an enormous impact. It has always seen itself as much more linked with other states outside of Africa than it has seen itself linked with the rest of Africa. There are some exceptions to that, but on the whole, it isn't. But I mean, you know, we have, you know, a quarter of the population, according to government statistics, are unemployed. A third of the adult population are probably actually unemployed. And they need a 6% growth rate, according to the government, to reduce that. Now, they aren't even close.
They are nowhere close. The finance minister, Mr. Gordhan, is announcing tax rises, spending cuts, civil service job freeze. Is any of that actually going to help, do you think?
Not in time. No, it's far too little, which is why you had a 3% fall in the share price. I mean, in the rand, even after his announcement, and it's heading to be have a junk bond status any moment now. I mean, it's probably by the end of the year, I think. But it's a tragic situation because South Africa has I feel deeply about it. It's my home country originally, at least, and I still feel a lot about it. And it has a lot to offer, but it has to really have fundamental reform. But you are absolutely right. The Democratic Alliance is a real opposition, and it may take two more regions in this year's local government elections, which would leave it with the Western Cape, possibly parts of the Eastern Cape, and possibly the area around Johannesburg. Now, nobody knows that for sure, but that is certainly a possibility. And if that happens, they then really are on the map.
Okay, well, let's look finally this evening at Syria, which has for some years now given every impression of being the definitively unsolvable problem, though this does not, of course, stop people from trying. The latest to have a bash is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who, displaying the inordinate self-belief that is his family's hallmark, has unburdened himself of a remarkably boring and silly piece in Politico, suggesting that it's all America's fault. It's pretty much the standard Pilger-esque bleating about America's ruthless desire for oil, a commodity of which, before the war began, Syria was a smaller producer than Papua New Guinea or New Zealand. Zania, first of all, is there any particular reason why we should be terrifically interested in what Robert Kennedy Jr. thinks about anything other than whitewater rafting, which appears to be his primary area of expertise?
I'm going to move off Kennedy as an individual and perhaps move towards his arguments.
Elegantly done.
My pleasure. He makes a couple of valid points. You know, I mean, he essentially says that, you know, the American tendency, and I should say this is not a uniquely American tendency. This is arguably a global tendency to say we've got nothing to do with it. It's all the others' fault. Is not terribly helpful, and But he makes the equal and opposite contention, which is actually it's all America's fault, and it's really not the fault of the region at all, which is equally in error. So, I mean, I think he kind of takes he makes some interesting arguments over history and today about America's responsibility, in particular the responsibility of the CIA, in fostering coups, in fostering unrest in the Middle East. Is there any question that the American government, including the CIA, has had a role in trying to ensure that a pro-American government has been in power in a number of Middle Eastern countries? No, of course not. By the way, so have the Russians, so have the Brits, and so have many other countries
tried to
ensure, including the Chinese more recently. So, you know, that is not new. He takes the point, I would perhaps diplomatically say, rather too far by insisting that it's all the Americans' fault and actually the region has no culpability in this.
I mean, it is a fairly common thing, Martin, that we've heard a lot, especially since September 11th, 2001, this idea that, and I would actually argue seriously that it is an outright racist depiction of Arabs, that they are completely incapable of making their own decisions or having their own ideas, and that everything they do is just merely a reaction to Western provocation. There was a quote that leapt out at me where he says, "We might want to look beyond the convenient explanations of religion and ideology." What if there's a reason those explanations are convenient? I.e. that they're correct?
Well, it's a very good point that you make. I mean, there's, you know, he's not the only person that makes this point. And I
Indeed
don't know
not.
How many people have watched Bitter Lake by Adam Curtis, which was a BBC production, never shown on television, but available on YouTube and worth watching, even if it's more than 2 boring hours long. And that is, frankly, that, you know, a deal was done between the Americans and the Saudis at the end of the Second World War. And frankly, the Saudis were told, you get on with any kind of religion you want and we'll leave you in control of that. You look after selling us oil and fighting the communists and we will never intervene. And one of the fascinating points about the current situation that we're in is that if you look at the vast war that's going on between American fracking organization companies and the Saudis by pushing the oil down, which is what's going on, where do you see a squeak from the Americans complaining about it? You just don't. And it's fascinating that they're being so quiet about it.
Here's what we've got to remember. You know, whether it's the Americans, as I say, the Americans, the Brits, the Russians, the Chinese, every country is going to pursue what it perceives to be its best national interest.
Yeah.
Now, the argument that I think he is making, if you take his specifics up to 30,000 foot, is that actually we haven't been pursuing, we, America, has not been pursuing our best interest in the Middle East because what we've been doing by being involved and by our kind of subterfuge is actually having long-term detrimental effects on America's reputation, on America's ability to actually have governments in the region who are lean towards the United States. And so he's actually, I think he's making a point, and I would put the policy prescription at the end of his point, which is we need to change the way we act in the Middle East or else this will be propagated, this will continue.
Although, Martin, his solution appears to be that America should just leave the Middle East alone. Is there any reason to believe that in that circumstance the whole thing would just magically sort itself out?
Well, clearly not. But I think one of the interesting things that seems to be happening in the Middle East is that we went through this brief flirtation with democracy, that the Arab Spring, and it was all going to be wonderful. And frankly,
nice
we've crept back into our previous position, which was, for goodness sake, let's have a few good dictators that we can deal with because we know how to do it.
This is the he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch model.
Yes. Not always put quite as directly as that, but yes.
Originally attributed to Franklin Roosevelt about Antonio Somoza. So it's
a fine man.
A fairly universally applicable foreign policy, unfortunately. Martin Plout, Xenia Wickett, we will have to leave it there. That is all we have time for. Thank you very much for joining us on today's Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Yasmin Omar. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Our international playlist continues next at 1900 hours, which is in half an hour from now. You can hear Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck with The Urbanist, and The Daily has more on the day's big stories at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, thanks for listening. I'm Andrew Muller. Goodbye.